Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you very much for joining us. Let's meet our guest, Paul Jenkins of the Anchorage Daily Planet, Jill Burke of the Alaska Dispatch, and welcome back to Scott Christensen of the Anchorage Press. The oil tax debate heats up in Juneau as legislators in the Senate hear testimony from prominent oil executives on changes they would like to see in our oil tax regimen. And the wordsmiths are busy as we're hearing all about the demand for meaningful reform, and there's even going to be a demonstration next week, a meaningful demonstration. Paul, what's the latest report from Juneau?
Meaningful means more, much more is what it means. What we have is the Senate bill that stands instead of the House Bill 110 is now in the Senate Finance Committee. Oil executives testified there this past week, and essentially told them that what they're offering amounts to 200, as far as ACES reform, Alaska Clear and Equitable Share oil tax reform, is not enough. That it amounts to something like $300 million if oil prices were even a little higher than they are now. They're saying they need more in a meaningful way. They won't put a figure on it. When asked about it, an executive said, well, you'll know you're there when things start happening.
I don't know much about art, but I know what I like.
I know what I like.
I know meaningful when it's meaningful to me.
That's exactly right. You got that right. So this particular measure the problem, of course, we go back to ACES, the problem is always going to be progressivity. It goes up incrementally, and it's sweeping. It takes in everything behind it. At some point, it leads to a very high marginal tax rate, discourages investment and production. One part of the Senate measure, when they first started talking about it, they wanted to cut that off. We'll cut that off at $250 a barrel oil, and that's ridiculous. Well, now they're saying, well, we'll do it at $150, and the oil companies are saying, we like it at about $100. So the progressivity would stop then. The oil companies who actually have to deal with the risk at the lower prices will then be able to capitalize at the higher prices.
Paul, before we move on here, is it your sense that the companies would be willing to accept what they can get out of a bill this year that might not be exactly what Parnell is advocating, or even their representatives have advocated, rather than say that they just couldn't get anything out of the Senate?
They have pledged in a way. It's a pretty informal pledge to spend $5 billion on the North Slope. With the right amount of tax reform, I don't think they'll take less than they need. Those are businesses. They have a bottom line. They're not going to take less than anything that would enhance their bottom line. They're not a social organization. They're not there for Alaska's benefit. They're there to make a profit for their shareholders. And when that bottom line is broached or breached, they probably will wait till the next legislature before they accept it.
And that is very possible. Before we move on, I wanted to say a few things, having watched some of the hearings, and in particular, I wanted to note that something that created quite a stir in Juneau was a letter that Governor Parnell sent the 16th to Bert Stedman and other members of the State Senate Finance Committee. The letter was chastising them for their approach to tax reform, oil tax reform, and telling the senators more or less that they needed to immediately adjust their view and come around to the governor's point of view on his bill. What was striking about this letter, and very unusual, and why I mention it, is that the tone of it from the beginning was to chastise Bert Stedman and other members of the Senate, and it wasn't, I mean, most of this was not persuasive speech. This was, you're wrong, buddy, and you better get your head straightened out. It's very rare to see a governor write that kind of a letter to a member of the legislature, especially a member of his own party, and I think it's the kind of thing that has its own risks in it, whatever the governor's intentions were, that it would just perhaps harden Stedman's perspective and his loyalty to his members of his caucus. That letter is floating around. It's online for those of you who want to read it. And you can find out about chicken and eggs in there, too, as Parnell makes quite a bit of that. Okay, Scott, our Anchorage is drawing near to the municipal election. The Anchorage Press has a profile of Paul Honeyman. Tell us in some detail about who is Paul Honeyman.
Well, the profile is by our freelancer, David Holthouse. And
very experienced writer at this point. Yeah.
Yeah, he's been with the Daily News before and at the Anchorage Press. And Paul's story, he grew up in South Carolina. He has he relates strongly with the civil rights movement. And there's a story within the story where Paul talks about that, about an experience growing up involving a Klan rally near his hometown, which is something growing up in Alaska, we just, you know, it's kind of different. He comes squarely from the middle. He's a member of the National Association for Advancement of Colored People. He's also a member of the National Rifle Association. When they ask him about partisan politics, he's been nonpartisan ever since he registered to vote in Alaska in the early 80s. He says, "I'm some of both and all of neither," is his sort of message describing himself. David was tracking the campaign, however, just as Honeyman's name came up in the cop lawsuit, which involves a group of women who are suing the city over the actions of Anthony Rawlins.
A convicted sex offender.
A convicted sex offender who's committing his offenses as a police officer. And Honeyman speaks to that in the story, and he has a message that he's been trying to take to voters, trying to explain that and backpedal that. The campaign's very much on defense, I think. And
well, we should, can I jump in for this minute? So the backstory to that is a report came out about what APD knew about the Rawlins affair. And in that report is a mention of Honeyman when he was taking over as public affairs officer at APD, walking in on Rawlins, possibly with a woman in the room after hours on premises at the police station. And the Sullivan campaign took that as kind of an aha. He saw this. He said nothing. They were both police officers at the time. And that's where we get to where this campaign takes this negative turn, or it has hurt, the Rawlins issue has hurt Honeyman to some degree.
Yeah, and it's hurt him without the mayor's campaign for reelection having to do much of anything, because this is news. Everybody knows there's this lawsuit going on. We expect reporters to track it. Sure enough, reported the Daily News tracked the lawsuit, and attorneys got all this stuff out of APD about their failure to stop Anthony Rawlins.
And it's not exactly a strong position for Honeyman to be saying, I followed standard procedure as outlined by the department. Isn't that what he's saying, Joe?
Yeah, I believe so. And he, you know, his story is he had his wife and maybe somebody else there to kind of give them a tour of his new offices. He escorted them out of the secure part of the building, went back to that room, and Rawlins and his guest were gone.
And the clear implication was the guest and the officer were engaging in sexual activity.
That's
right?
The implication, yes. And so, you know, Honeyman's defense has been, look, I reported it to my superiors. I did what I was supposed to do, you know.
Yeah, I think, and I've heard this from people who have attended community council meetings and watched him face to face. I know from our own, from David's story, Paul Honeyman's good at giving this message one-to-one to voters. But we don't know if one-to-one works in an election campaign.
Mm-hmm. And of course, there are some people who are on the other side. They may not be members of the mayor's campaign, but they support him, who will say, aha, Jacques, you've been seen here. We found out something about you, and it's not flattering.
Oh, yeah. The surrogates in talk radio are on this.
Okay. Let's move to another aspect of the campaign. Proposition 5, dubbed the Equal Rights Amendment or Special Rights Amendment, depending on whom you talk to in this campaign, is drawing all kinds of attention with more and more advertising in the newspaper and on the air and on television. Paul, what can you tell us?
Essentially, it's a fight over the anti-Proposition 5 forces say that this proposition, which adds essentially protection for gay and lesbians and transgender folks, is an affront to civil liberties, to their religious freedom. The other side, the pro Prop 5 people, say there is discrimination in this town. They had a recent survey that shows 60 or 70% don't talk about their homosexuality because they're afraid of repercussions and what could happen. So there's the pro Prop 5 side's got well over $200,000 in campaign fund. The other side doesn't seem to have more than $5,000 or $10,000. I haven't looked recently, so it's a pretty lopsided thing financially. But I think, as we've spoken here before, this kind of thing doesn't need a lot of money on either side. The people involved in this are committed, I think, and it's sold as religious freedom, and that's basically where we're at.
Jill, can advertising change minds in a contest like this, or is this essentially a turnout election, reminding people who have strong feelings about this and presumably are on your side to get out there and vote?
I suspect that this is largely solidifying the bases that are on either side here. This is going to be the call to action to make sure that people get out, the kind of fear-mongering, the rhetoric of the extreme. I worry on a personal level that some of the misinformation that has come out in the advertising might sway somebody who would otherwise be apathetic based on a religious impingement, a religious freedom, a religious liberty issue to come out and vote, and that they wouldn't look at it much deeper than that. And
the pro people are at pains to remind us, and they've reminded me in emails, that there are a number of pastors, a number of congregations that are supportive of the change. It isn't all on the negative side. I think, what is there, 35 pastors or something have signed a letter?
I don't remember what the exact number is, but there are quite a few people in the religious community who have come out on the pro side. And I can say as personally, not as a reporter for Alaska Dispatch, but I have found this issue to be quite offensive because I'm a member of the affected community. I work alongside gay people. I'm a gay person. I have a partner. We have children. I've experienced discrimination since my appearance in Alaska. It's been minor, and obviously I've been successful, but I think that it's kind of the rhetoric and the intentional misreading of the ramifications of what this change in law seeks to do is offensive, and I find it deceitful. And I wish that there was more conversation about that and about the reality instead of the extremes of what might happen.
Okay, thank you. Scott, there are advantages, obviously, to the pro side receiving thousands of dollars from Planned Parenthood of the Pacific Northwest, but it also seems to me there could be disadvantages. Some people have very strong feelings about Planned Parenthood, not to mention gay people.
Well, yeah, there are circles where Planned Parenthood just comes up. It's like there was a point where the word liberal was so tarnished, people couldn't say I'm a liberal. You know, in fact, they still have some of that, continually calling themselves progressive. I think that can hurt them, but only among people who are already leaning to vote against them. That's what I think. I think that they're right to accept some money and put out a strong campaign that says they believe this is good for Anchorage, that we believe this is good for Anchorage.
Similar, the anti-side enjoys an advantage by putting together a number of congregations, church congregations under conservative ministers, who they can turn out the vote. They've done that in elections a lot tamer than this. But I wonder if, to some degree, being identified with certain clergymen, Jerry Prevost, for example, if at some point that can hurt you, just like being identified with Planned Parenthood.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, there are clergymen who feel it's their duty to weigh in on politics all of the time. And then there are other clergymen and women who will weigh in on politics only when they believe it's necessary. This campaign, there's a strong message from Jerry Prevost available on his website, and he
Reverend Prevost have to say on his website? I've missed it. I should look, but I haven't yet.
Well, he starts in with words like depraved, and it's pretty offensive, and then he claims that religious liberty is at stake, that people are going to be harmed by this. He quotes a little bit from one of Julie O'Malley's columns where she talks about not feeling discriminated against in her professional life, and he shows that as proof that there's no discrimination in Anchorage, We also know that when this issue was at the assembly in 2009, people who were going to the assembly to speak in the public forum felt as if they needed to be escorted there, that they needed escorts in and out of the library to talk to politicians.
On the other hand, Reverend Prevost, if he were here, I'm sure would tell some version of this is an important matter to him. He has strong feelings about it, and he's trying to vigorously rally his team, right, or his troops.
Yeah, he would do that. He would do it probably in a very kind way. You know, he's.
I can just chime in here briefly.
Go ahead.
I mean, part of what we hear in this message is there was no proof of discrimination. Well, there's a reason there wasn't proof of discrimination, and that's because the tool that's used to collect that was deficient because sexual orientation was not one of the things that were allowed to
categories.
Be categories to be marked and tracked. So of course there's going to be no proof. So then to say, to know that the tool is deficient and then to say there's no proof of discrimination, but be sure to vote no on 5 because we would like to maintain our freedom to discriminate is kind of laughable on some level to me. I just don't, it doesn't really resonate with me very well. And I really believe in, you know, the firm discourse. I think we're going to see both sides come out very, very strongly the closer that Election Day gets.
And we are getting close.
Yeah, we're getting very close. The countdown is clearly underway, and I think we're going to see a real grassroots effort on both sides. You know, Pastor Jerry Prevost and his community pushing people to get out and vote, and
you want to tell us about
folks.
The rally that's going on right now.
Yeah, that's an important point. So, you know, as we speak now, there's a rally in Town Square Park, which is, I can't remember the exact name of it, but it's a religious freedom rally.
Here in Anchorage.
And it's part of a national campaign centered on the birth control issue in the Health and Human Services bill that has a lot of people very upset that that would force them to administer health care that is in violation of their deeply held beliefs. And Jim Minery, who is kind of the tip of the spear on the anti-campaign here for Prop 5, believes that that's a very close parallel to what's being experienced in Anchorage at the local level with Proposition 5 and the expanded Equal Rights Ordinance. So there, you know, I haven't been down there to personally see it yet since I'm here, but I imagine there's some turnout.
Okay. Scott, briefly, Anchorage won the proponents of the legislation, the ballot initiative, seemed to have a great deal of confidence. You've looked at some of the numbers. Why?
You can look at long-term trends, and you can look at long-term trends on individual precincts if you look at certain state elections. And I'm talking about 1998, the marriage amendment to the state constitution. And then in 2007, there was this fuzzy advisory vote on whether state employees with same-sex partners could have health care for their dependents and family members. And what happens is even in the most conservative precincts, you find a shift. More and more people are voting on behalf of human rights for gay people in 2007 than were in 1998. And those are quite far apart. But it lends confidence when, particularly when you look at Anchorage precincts. And the thing about this election is there are many super voters out there who will go to every election, they feel a duty to vote, but who are squarely in the middle on most things. And I think that, you know, the silent majority and the moral majority are two different things in this world.
Okay, and it may also be that people who have strong feelings about gay marriage don't have as strong of feelings about discrimination questions in the workplace.
Access to the Equal Rights Commission is what it is. You get access to the Equal Rights Commission, which is a venue to talk about what's happened.
Okay, once again, I'm Michael Carey. I'm here with Paul Jenkins, Scott Christensen, and Jill Burke. Jill, you covered the Iditarod this year from beginning to end. It's quite an experience. Most of us don't get a chance to see how what it's really like to cover the last great race. Why don't you tell us something about your experience? And this is not your first time out there, right?
No, I mean, I should say I'm a little disappointed that my Daily News colleague Kyle Hopkins and I have not been celebrated as 3-time Iditarod finishers now as of this year's finish. The race is fun. It's really an adventure, even on the sidelines, covering it as a member of the press. We track the mushers as they advance across the trail. Of course, we have the luxury of going by plane instead of dog team. I guess that I would consider that a luxury. I'm not sure after seeing some of these people roll through the checkpoints day after day that I would want to do this. But, you know, it's amazing that the athleticism in the dogs is really incredible. It's interesting to watch just the physical stamina of the mushers themselves. Interviews start to break down a little bit the more tired they get into the race. You know, they can get a little loopy and a little clumsy, and they're really focused on just taking care of their dogs, taking care of themselves, getting themselves fed, getting themselves to bed. And you start getting answers like, so, you know, such and such, you know, Paul Jenkins is nipping on your heels. He's closing the gap. How do you intend to stop that from happening as you advance toward Nome? And you get an answer like, be the first to Nome, you know? So these kind of like real obvious answers, which are part humorous and I think part truthful. They just want you to kind of get out of their face and let them do their job. But they tend to be very indulgent and a lot of fun, and it's fun to see them come through the communities. The communities really enjoy these mushers coming through. And this year we had kind of a new lineup at the front end of the pack. We had Allie Zirkel, an incredible female.
Looked like she was going to win for
a long
time.
Like she was going to win, an incredible female competitor with an incredible team. And women and girls in the villages were so excited to see her come through.
Oh, that's a great story.
Which was nice. Yeah. And even some of the men, you know, were just like, it's about time for a woman. But then you have Dallas Seavey, who rallied at the end and, you know, was kind
youngest of youngest winner ever.
Youngest winner ever. And really another nice guy. And it was fun to see him win. And him, he had this very focused strategy and he executed it and it paid off. And as soon as he knew that he was, you know, no one was going to be able to close the gap, he just kind of had this wave of relief that came over him, and this intensity that you see in him kind of sloughed off a little bit, and he was more relaxed, which was a pleasure to see. But yeah,
thank you, Jill. So, really nice storytelling. Appreciate it. Paul, let's skip ahead. The report Judge Emmett Sullivan commissioned or asked for on misconduct on the Ted Stevens trial came out at the end of last week. You weren't here. You've had a week to reflect. Your reflections, please.
There's only one word to describe. It's despicable what happened to Ted Stevens. Judge Sullivan, God bless him, federal judge out of Washington, D.C., ordered up an investigation of the prosecution of Ted Stevens. It found the prosecution manufactured evidence, inflated evidence, lied about evidence, covered their star witnesses, foibles and possible crimes to avoid having him impeached under cross-examination. The government, frankly, if there's a railroad job that would be in a textbook, this one would be it. He had everything stacked against him from day one. He never had a chance. Cost him the election, cost Alaska a senior senator, a man so powerful that he kept Alaska at the forefront for 40 years, and we've lost him. So there's another investigation pending by the Justice Department. We'll wait and see what that one says. All of these and prosecutors, except the one who committed suicide, are still employed by the federal government, if you can believe that. If you or I committed these crimes in a federal court, we'd be in prison right now. And I don't know what it takes.
I've often wondered if Judge Sullivan, who I watched that trial, so yep. He is a very commanding, kind of thundering judge when he needs to be. And he minced no words in dealing with what he perceived as to be lapses in the duty of prosecutors to be handling their evidence and reporting accurately. And that was even during the trial itself. But I've often wondered if he has any regrets or nags or winces in his private moments at home about whether he should have ordered the government to comply with its
this
obligations.
This is a key element of that.
Is a key element, instead of just saying that he intends them to follow the law. Because had there been an order, according to the report written by the special prosecutor, Henry Schulke, then they would have been in violation and contempt charges could have flowed from that. But because there was no order for which the prosecutors were in direct violation,
it's unbelievable.
They couldn't proceed with contempt. Which is an interesting, you know, subtle but very significant distinction.
And was
could
very,
have been a 15-second, you know, verbal statement from the judge, and we might have criminal charges.
Just very briefly, then I got to get him in here.
Isn't it incredible that a judge has to tell federal prosecutors obey the law?
Well, I think Judge Sullivan, the implication here was clearly What else is going on around here in court that I don't know about?
Yeah, exactly.
Scott, very quickly, Representative Mike Dugan, a former colleague of ours, hosted a Tea Party and none of the Republicans showed up. What was that all about?
Oh, Dugan offered some amendments to the budget on the floor, knowing that he's a minority member, a Democrat, and that the Republicans wouldn't help him adopt these amendments.
And they were conservative budget cutting or money saving.
He attacked programs. He went after tourism marketing money. He wanted to take away $8 million from that until the industry matches the state's money. He attacked the aerospace corporation on Kodiak. He wanted to take away $8 million of that. And then he attacked a radio system that's used by various police and fire agencies around the state, which he says the feds ought to be paying for. It amounted to about $19 million. He claims there was another $30 million in capital funds that would go to these programs, so they could have saved $50 million. And there's just a little irony that, you know, the Democrats have to offer cuts, and they know they won't get them in a Republican-controlled House.
Did he get any Democratic votes?
Yeah, they were along with him. I think one Republican, Bill Stoltz, accidentally voted in favor of one amendment and then had to change his vote.
Well, this is no accident. We're out of time. Thank you for joining us so much on Alaska Edition. See you next week. Good day.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskaedition@alaskapublic.org. Or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.